Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Our producers, Harriet Williamson and Travis Stanzel, and Jason Croft at the controls. Glad you could listen. About 83% of all garments sold in the United States are now made elsewhere. 80% of the toys, 90% of the sporting goods, and 95% of the shoes. Who is making these things and under what conditions? In the past 2 years, more than 2 million U.S. manufacturing jobs have disappeared. We keep buying more stuff, so what happened to those jobs? During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk with someone who has been following that particular trail and finding things about global labor many of us would perhaps rather not know. Charles Kernighan is executive director of the National Labor Committee, a human rights advocacy group dedicated to promoting and defending the rights of workers. Charles Kernighan has become known, among other things, as the man who made Kathy Lee Gifford cry by pointing out that Kathy Lee pants sold at Walmart for 1996 were made in a sweatshop by children earning only 25 cents a pair. Charles Kernighan has been on a sweatshop tear and has called attention to some of the worst labor abuses an American consumer would rather not imagine in Haiti, Central America, Asia, and elsewhere, involving companies such as Nike, The Gap, and Disney Corporation. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll hear the latest on National Labor Committee investigations of sweatshops around the world and talk about how corporations and consumers can take responsibility for improving labor conditions in the global economy. As we talk with Charles Kernighan, we invite you into the conversation. All you have to do is call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. And Charles Kernighan joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning, Mr. Kernighan.
Yes, good morning.
Good. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great.
There are many things to talk about, but perhaps we could start by asking you to talk about the recent delegation to Bangladesh.
Good. Actually, I just wanted to make a comment on
sure.
some of your figures earlier. It's actually gotten worse in terms of the amount of imports coming in, percentages. Right now, the apparel industry is saying 96% of all apparel purchased in the United States is imports.
Wow.
And it's not just apparel, as you pointed out. Now, more than 50% of all the manufactured goods we purchase in the United States are imports. You know, and again, there's nothing wrong with that if there's a level playing field and if worker rights are respected. To give an example, like you said, Bangladesh, we were in Bangladesh, in the city of Chittagong. Just tell you about one meeting with a worker we had. So mm-hmm. That's the port city. There's a big free trade zone there, 55,000 workers producing garments for export to the United States. And we meet with this young worker, and she tells us she works in a company called MNC. It's a very big company, 3,000 workers. They were making clothing for Walmart. And she says to us that she's working from 7:30 in the morning until 9 or 10 o'clock at night, 14 and a half hours a day. She says, however, every other day, they're forcing us to work straight through to 3 a.m. So they're working from 7:30 in the morning straight through to 3 o'clock in the morning. They work in a 19-and-a-half-hour shift every other day. And after that 19-hour shift, they curl up next to their sewing machines, and they sleep in the factory on the ground, on the floor. The factory is very crowded, so there's not even any place to stretch out. 7 days a week they're working. She had only 2 days off in the last 4 months when we spoke to her. Her job was to put the labels, mark the labels, mark the place where the labels would go on the garment so when the cloth flew down the assembly line, the woman could grab it and put the label on very quickly. She had to put on 200 marks or labels an hour, one every 18 seconds. And then she tells us, she says, when I don't reach my production goal, my manager, who's a man much bigger than she was, would lean over and slap her in the face quite hard, jerking her head back and forth, as he whispered in her ear that she was a whore and a prostitute and a mother was a prostitute. And we asked her how old she was, and she said she was 13 years old. Her name was Selena, a 13-year-old child working 7 days a week, 13 and a half hours a day, up to 19 hours a day. Her wages, she was paid 7 cents an hour, she said, 55 cents a day, about $3.80 a week. She told us she was on her feet all day. And with those long hours, her legs would swell up, her feet would swell up. They would sometimes, when she didn't make her production quota, they'd make her stand on a bench in front of all her coworkers and pull her ears down like a little kid in school. And in Bangladesh, that's an extreme sign of embarrassment and humiliation. We were really shocked, and when the interview ended, we started to move away. The last thing she said to us, she said, "You know, I feel like I'm dying. I'm so sick and I'm so exhausted." And, you know, we've seen a lot in the developing world over these years, but things like this, they blow you away. And this is a 13-year-old kid essentially working for the largest company in the world, Walmart, and it doesn't have to be like this. They were paid 10 cents for every Walmart jacket they made. By the way, they were making children's clothing, so this was another case of children making clothing for other children. In the United States, they were paid 10 cents for every $20 jacket they made. It doesn't have to be like this. Walmart's the biggest company in the world. In fact, they're $246.5 billion a year in sales, make Walmart larger than 161 countries in the world. I mean, that's power, so they don't have to abuse these little kids. Walmart's profits last year were $8 billion. They don't have to take it off the backs of little kids like this. The Walton family is worth $93 billion. They don't have to take it off the backs of these kids. And so I think there's an awful lot of this in the global economy. Like you said, the U.S. people are just unaware of.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does this work? Now, they work for Walmart, but there's a company in between. How does that all fit together?
Well, U.S. companies don't invest in brick and mortar any longer.
Yeah.
So Walmart, which is the largest company in the world and the largest retailer, it doesn't own a single factory. So they contract the work out. I mean, it's good for them because it gives them a contingency workforce all over the world. They're not responsible for that workforce. They can pull their work at any minute. And so, for example, Walmart uses, this is astounding, they use 4,400 factories in one province in China alone. Now, added to this, the ability to use factories all over the world, and they contract with these factories, added to that is they hide these factories. And companies like Walmart or Nike or any of them, they refuse to give the American people even the name and address of the factories they use to make the goods we purchase. So the workers were making the Walmart label, but Walmart does not own the factory. This is very common.
Mm-hmm. Now, Walmart is rather well known in the industry for their information management. They have some kind of system that tracks prices and, you know, shipments and items, and uses this as a way to lower their costs, at least, or to get people to lower their bids for stuff that they sell to Walmart. And certainly that must play into this somehow.
Well, I mean, exactly. I mean, they have the largest private sector data bank in the world, and they track this stuff. They follow it. That's one of the reasons for their success. But when you go into a Walmart or you see these ads that they're going to roll back prices, they're going to give you every day lower prices, they're going to give you a good deal. In fact, I mean, that's based on rolling back wages and working conditions and benefits and standards all over the world. I mean, Walmart is leading in this race to the bottom. I mean, you opened your show mentioning the 2.78 million jobs lost in this economy since 2001 when President Bush came into office. I mean, we're losing 100,000 jobs a month, a net loss. And of those, about 66,000 of those are manufacturing jobs that we're losing. And what we're seeing is that great sucking sound that Ross Perot spoke about, you know, whether he was well-intentioned or right, but this is taking place right now. And it's taking place not to Mexico, but basically to China and to other countries that pay these extraordinary low wages. And again, it's not just garments; it's everything.
Mm-hmm. Now, just you know, I want to get on some other companies, but to focus on Walmart just for just a minute longer or so. Walmart, as you know, as we mentioned, has this system of managing their information and their costs. Surely they must know. I mean, do they say they don't know the conditions of the people in these factories?
Well, they actually have lied. I mean, it sounds extraordinary, but we found many people thought that Kathy Lee changed after that original episode when she shed the crocodile tears around the children in Honduras making her pants. But not long after that, we found Kathy Lee pocketbooks, which are a private label for Walmart, being made in China. In a factory called Kanshi, workers were being forced to work from 7 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night. 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, for an average wage of 3 cents an hour, $2.94 a week for the official 98-hour work week. And we, of course, the workers were beaten. They were housed in miserable dormitories. They were fed dismal meals. When we brought this up, of course, there's no rights in China to organize. You'd be imprisoned right away. When we brought this up to Walmart, they said, we've never even heard of that factory. We're not in that factory. You're making it up. You're lying. You're just after publicity. And, you know, they would have gotten away with it, except the very radical journal Business Week came to us and said, look, you mind if we follow up on this factory? And, of course, we gave them the contacts. Business Week went to the factory in China, in Guangdong province, confirmed that Walmart had been in the factory, was in the factory, confirmed that conditions were every bit as bad as we said they were. In fact, 800 workers had been fired for asking for their rights. And then when Business Week confronted Jay Allen, the vice president of Walmart, and they said, well, look, why were you lying? And he had to respond. He said, look, we were lying because we're defensive about the sweatshop issue. So this is a company which has a long history, going back to Bangladesh in 1994, where there were kids who were 5 to 8 years old sewing Walmart garments, sometimes being forced to work until midnight. When the kids fell asleep, the managers would slap the kids, bring them awake. When those images were shown to David Glass, the CEO of Walmart at the time, it was an undercover NBC Dateline show, David Glass said, well, those images don't mean anything to me. Perhaps you and I define child labor differently. And then they came out and put their hands over the camera, the Walmart staff people. The owner of the factory in Bangladesh that had been producing for Walmart for years, he said to the Dateline people, he said, look, there's a lot of confusion here. There's a great misunderstanding. You only think those are children. They're really malnourished adults. And so you're talking, Walmart would be the biggest example, but you're really talking about in many corporations, in this race to the bottom of the global economy, they've lost their moral compass. There's nothing there other than the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. How do you actually go about, you've uncovered a number of these stories. How do you find out about these situations?
Well, we're a very small organization. When you do this kind of thing, you're certainly not funded by the major foundations. When people hear worker rights or labor rights, people with money run the opposite direction. So it's very hard, just even financially, to go forward. But once you get to these countries, you know, there are always excellent local groups you can work with, women's organizations, religious groups, local unions. So, for example, in Bangladesh, where there are 1.8 million young women, I'm talking, you know, 16 to 25 years of age. In Bangladesh, you know, you produce garments for Disney, for example. When you reach 30 or 35, you're fired and driven out of the factory. And actually say, the contractors actually say, Disney doesn't allow gray hair, doesn't allow gray hairs. It's not actually like that. It's just that they want to get rid of the older workers because they're burned out after working, you know, 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. They want to replace them with another crop of young girls. So you see this all over the world. But when you go to a place like Bangladesh, even there, where there's 1.8 million workers and 3,600 garment factories, there's not one single union. Every time the workers try to exercise their legal rights, they're crushed, blacklisted, illegal firings. Even there, there are very excellent unions working underground. They have to work clandestinely. And their connections in the factories are phenomenal. So we set up secret meetings. I mean, almost in all of these countries, within a matter of days, you can have secret meetings in hidden locations with hundreds of workers. Mm-hmm. And they know to bring the labels that they produce, so you know what U.S. company they ultimately work for. They know to bring their pay stubs, so you know what they earn. They come with company documents, their piece rates and all. You know, it's not that hard. You can do it. The real problem is actually finding the factories. Like I said, the companies hide those factories. But once you can locate the factory, almost anywhere in the world you can reach workers, and they're more than ready to talk if they think that you're going to work with them so that they can gain their rights.
Now, this is going to sound like an incredibly chauvinistic question, but do they understand that, you know, they're making a garment, you know, as you say, for pennies that is going to sell for, you know, for $20, $30, and do they understand the sort of implications of that, that they are being essentially exploited?
It's an excellent question, and to explain this or just lay it out the way it is, in the global economy, these big multinational companies have gone out around the world. For Nike, for example, has 500,000 workers in 50 different countries. They put their arms around mostly young women. I mean, 80 to 85% of the workers who are making our Walkmans and our clothing and our jeans and televisions, they're young women. They're brought into the global economy. They don't have a clue as to where they fit. So, for example, if you can imagine Bangladesh, they don't have the information you're referring to. It's a different script altogether. The label, they can't even read. It's like it would be like us looking at, you know, Bengali or Mandarin. It means nothing. And they never, and on top of not being able to read the labels, they have never heard of these companies. Women were working on Disney garments in Bangladesh for 8 years. They didn't have any idea what Walt Disney was or what the Disney company was. When you ask them, where does the clothing go to, they say it goes foreign. They don't even know it comes to the United States. And you press them a little bit, don't you know where it goes? And they say, well, we think it goes to white people for their pleasure. That was the most they knew. In fact, when we walked into neighborhoods in Bangladesh, some of the people asked us if we were from Korea. And then they said, are you from China? They hadn't seen North Americans coming into these poor neighborhoods before. So one of the most important points here is, in fact, that these young women are taken into the global economy with no tools to defend themselves. They've never heard of these companies. They don't know what the corporate profits are. They don't know what CEOs pay themselves. They don't know where the clothing goes. They don't know what the clothing sells for. They don't know what wages are in other parts of the world. And in many cases, they don't know their own labor laws. Although, they have an instinct, an internal, not an instinct, but they have a sense of justice and dignity where they don't want the companies to go beyond. So everywhere you go, these young people, whether they're the young women or the young men, they're standing up for their rights. But unfortunately, they're crushed. And without input on the part of the American people, it's really at this point, since the workers in China and Bangladesh or Honduras, since they're producing for export to the United States or Europe, they can't organize to win their rights alone on the ground if there's not also pressure in the marketplace, meaning us, like the American consumer. And there's only, like, this race to the bottom. It can only go further and further down if there's not some sort of movement in the United States and movement in Europe, the major consuming countries in Canada, to try to put some checks and balances on these corporations.
Well, we'll talk more about that. We have several callers I want to include in our conversation, and I also want to reintroduce our guest this morning during this hour, Focus 580. We're talking with Charles Kernighan. He's executive director of the National Labor Committee, an organization which investigates and publicizes sweatshop conditions around the world. And we have several callers waiting, so we'll go first to a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for this program, and thank you for the National Labor Committee. There are not many organizations like yours out there, and you're absolutely right. Corporations have lost any moral compass as to how to behave to workers, and all they care about is the bottom line. And I think back to, you know, the 1800s and the 1900s, and how hard our grandfathers and great-grandfathers fought for the rights of labor in this country. And then suddenly all the jobs that people used to have, because we did have rights in this company, in this country, were shipped out by the companies to all these developing countries where worker rights are brutally, as they were done here, brutally suppressed. And what can the American consumer do? I know that when I go shopping, everything I look at is made in China. So what can I as a consumer do to help your work in addition to making a contribution to your organization?
Well, it's, of course, a great question. And we can start with some hope, because the United States is the world's largest economy. Our our $10 trillion a year economy, we make up 22% of the global economy, of the world's economy. So we have, without a doubt, the people of the United States, the largest voice. If we care to use that voice, we really have the power to end child labor and sweatshop abuses. So the power is here, because we're the largest market. We are the consumers. The companies can take their work offshore, but they can't take their purchasing offshore. So we have the power. Will we exercise it? And one of the things we're saying right now, and this is very tough, but when you go around the developing world, the workers are not asking that their jobs be boycotted. For example, workers in Bangladesh stood up to the Walt Disney Company, where they had been sewing garments for 7 years in this factory, Shah Mukhtar, and they said, stop the beatings. Stop beating us, slapping us. Give us one day a week off. Our families are collapsing. Our children are sick and alone. Pay us our maternity leave, as the law demands. Pay us our overtime, as the law demands. Disney's response was to pull out of the factory, throw all of the women on the street with nothing, and make an example of them, that if you dare question us, the Disney Corporation, well, you're going to be out on the street with nothing, fired and blacklisted. So basically, we're in a global economy where the workers in the developing world desperately need these jobs, just as much as we need jobs in the United States. They're not asking for boycotts. What they're asking for is pressure on the companies, to do the right thing, to treat them like human beings, to pay them a decent wages. So in many ways, these campaigns become moral campaigns to put enough pressure on the companies to embarrass them, to make them feel fear that their bottom line is going to be impacted. They spend $244 billion a year in the United States on advertising U.S. companies. Well, these negative stories, these negative campaigns, these embarrassments to the companies, it actually does solicit a response from them. And lastly, and obviously this is all connected to campaigns, and we're about to launch a whole slew of campaigns in China, Bangladesh, and Central America. But finally, this is the big issue, I think. The U.S. companies demand that their products be protected. So the label's protected, the trademark's protected, Nike's Swoosh is protected under intellectual property and copyright laws. So the companies say to all of us, they say, look, we need enforceable laws backed up by sanctions to defend our products. If there's not a level playing field in the global economy, we can't operate. Everything descends into chaos. And if you say back to the companies, well, it's somewhat reasonable. We accept that. But what about the rights of the 16-year-old girl in Bangladesh who made that product? Can't we also protect her fundamental human and woman and workers' rights? And the companies will look you in the eye and say, no, that's an impediment to free trade. So we allow a system, and we're sitting in the United States at this very minute, we allow a system where the product is legally protected. And if you violate that product or imitate it, you're going to go to jail, you're going to pay fines, Disney will drag you off to court if you imitate Mickey Mouse, but we have no protections for the human being. So there's no level playing field here. So we need to launch a massive public education drive to change these laws and to make sure that human beings are protected at least as much as products.
Wow. Okay, I know that in the past I have received documentation from organizations, and they've said, you know, please, if you agree with us, sign this statement and send it off to your senator, your representative, et cetera, your state representative, your state senator. Will you be doing anything like this, or do those people just, you know, throw those things in the circular file?
No, it's very, very valuable. And we do that. We're sending out a petition across the country now calling for this legislation to defend human beings. We're going to be going after the free trade agreement with the Americas, going after many of the biggest labels in the United States, writing letter campaigns. We're going to be bringing workers up from Central America in October and doing a tour of the country. We hope to come through Illinois. In other words, no, don't lose hope. The letters that you sent to members of Congress, they count. The letters that you sent to companies count. The companies tell us that every time they get a letter, they estimate that 500 other people feel the exact same way but didn't write. Every time they get a phone call, they say 250 people feel the same way but they didn't call. The only thing that's going to bring these companies back to respecting fundamental human and worker rights is a social movement. It really is the squeaky wheel which gets the grease. So in many ways, human rights organizations, what our job is, all of us, and as consumers, is to make a stink, to make it an issue. If it's an issue, the people in Washington blow over 2 seconds, in minutes, it's an issue. If it's not an issue, they're not going to respond. So basically, it's just to spread the word, make this an issue, never stop talking about it, tell other people about it, get involved in the campaigns. And really, if that can be done, we can change this global economy.
I'm thinking back to the Democratic the Democratic presidential hopefuls who were asked various questions at the various debates. And I remember Kucinich, who talked about repealing NAFTA and getting out of some other global trade organizations. And the people who disagreed with him on the platform talked about, no, that's too dangerous, things would collapse, et cetera, et cetera. Could I get your opinion on whether even just starting by repealing NAFTA would help? And would this really do away with America's economic health if we repealed NAFTA?
No, I think that really it is Denis Kucinich and Dick Gephardt who are leading that. Both of them have called for the repeal of NAFTA, and it actually would carry enormous potential, because what we've said all along is that the companies really make these trade agreements after the fact. I mean, everything is already in place. The trade agreement is supposed to nail it down in concrete so it can never change, so they know their investments are protected. What we're saying back is that these aren't written in stone. And if enough of us raise our voice, not only NAFTA, but also the World Trade Organization can be challenged. We don't have to sit back and allow these bureaucrats to design the world for us. The people have at least as much voice as the corporations. So if NAFTA was repealed and it was renegotiated, well, then worker rights could be made a core condition of these trading agreements and not put off on some useless sidebars. And, of course, we've lost 750,000 textile and apparel jobs since NAFTA came into place. So it is a very – I mean, I'm not sure the American people are there yet, because I'm not sure they have enough of the information – but at some point, these trade agreements must be reworked, and at the minimum, they must include worker rights protections, which are a core condition upon trade, and not just financial and property rights.
Okay. I'm sorry for hanging up on the last caller, where our lines are all full. I want to get on some other callers. I also want to ask real quickly, in addition to political and social pressure, are there some things that consumers can do by buying and not buying certain things? How do you know? People have to buy clothes. How do you make good choices?
Well, it's true. I mean, obviously, if you could buy clothing with a union label on it, you're buying clothing that's not made in a sweatshop. You're buying clothing by people that have a contract, that have a decent wage, that have health care, that have a pension. But it's hard. It's very difficult, in women's clothing especially. And with 96% of the clothing being imported, it makes it very, very difficult. I don't think we can shop our way out of sweatshops. I think only a social movement will end the child labor and the exploitation and the pennies an hour wages. Although we're experimenting with something now called an iCare shopper's card, so that it's a very small card, could fit in your pocket. And when you shop, you could hand in the card to the cashier, who gives it to the store manager, which says, myself and my family, we like shopping here, but we're very concerned that these products were not made by children or by any exploited worker paid pennies an hour. Tell me what you're doing to guarantee that this product was made under humane conditions. Will you release the name and address of the factory, and so on? So maybe even like that, every time we shop, we could leave a message behind.
Okay. Well, we have several callers waiting. There was one caller off the air who wanted to know if the National Labor Committee has a website, which indeed it does. NLCnet.org. So if you'd like to get more information about the National Labor Committee and the campaigns it's running, it's www.nlcnet.org. Let's go next to a listener in Champaign County on line number two. Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome back. Last time you were on, you were just launching the website. So I wanted to ask about the university-based movement, part of the social movement, and that's the universities make a lot of money on licensing their logos, and a lot of that stuff had been made in sweatshops, and I'm sure a lot of it still is. There are two different monitoring groups. The University of Illinois, I think, last I heard, was affiliated with both of them for some reason. And is what's your assessment of that nationwide? Are you tracking that? Is that doing some good as far as monitoring the conditions, and so that people get beyond, that's just a subcontractor, we don't have anything to do with it? I'm particularly fired up because I saw a Colombian Coca-Cola worker last night, and they don't export Coca-Cola into this country, but they do export money that comes up from the franchises, and they have a really sorry record there. I mean, this is beyond brutalizing people in their workplace. This is killing them and intimidating unions out, et cetera, et cetera. But what about these monitoring outfits?
Good, yeah. I think that Columbia case is critical, so it's great to support it in any way possible. The student movement, the United Students Against Sweatshops, and I've gone to a lot of campuses across the country, been fortunate enough to speak at the colleges, meet with the students. It's pretty strong, and it really caught the administrations by surprise. And so I think it's actually one of the bright spots in the country in the anti-sweatshop movement is the United Students Against Sweatshops. And what they fought for at the very beginning was that, of course, the garments that carry their university logo not be made by children, not be made in sweatshops, but that they be proud of wearing these garments. And at that moment, the company sort of circled the wagons and created something called the Fair Labor Association, which was one of the monitoring groups proposed. But on the board of directors of the FLA, the Fair Labor Association, was, of course, Nike and all the other companies. And it was set up in such a way that they would not disclose the name and address of the factories around the world that Nike and the other companies were using. They wouldn't release any monitoring reports publicly. What the public would get would be a sanitized summary of these reports not linked to specific factories. Only 5 to 30% of the factories would be monitored. The companies could choose the monitors and pay for them. And so, of course, they could choose Price Waterhouse or Ernst & Young or whoever they wanted. The students sort of drew the line in the sand and said, no, we're going to go with the Worker Rights Consortium, which is an independent monitoring organization and investigatory body, which does not have the companies on its board and does the investigations completely independently, calls for the disclosure of all the factory names and addresses that produce for the universities. This is still an ongoing battle, but it has led to some significant improvements. And in fact, the WRC has won some major cases in the Dominican Republic and Mexico. I mean, it's still small, but it's something. But the big thing is the student movement is key. It must keep going forward.
I don't want to digress too much from the sweatshop, but this guy was based out of the Solidarity Center, which is sponsored by the AFL-CIO, and an academic did come in and look in for a moment, and there is some talk of some universities getting together, supposedly, at least this is the impression that I got, and investigating the Columbia killings and that sort of thing. And it's sort of, it's not exactly as monitoring the factory place, but it's sort of saying that, well, we want to know. The U of I has a 10-year, and we're, I guess, 3 years into it or something, exclusive deal with Coca-Cola. So it's particularly incumbent that the university here find out, you know, where that Atlanta, Georgia-based company is pulling its money from, other than and giving it back here. Is the AFL-CIO working with you more than it had in the past, or what's going on with that?
Oh, yeah. In the past, if we had gone into the AFL-CIO, they would have thrown a net over us and dragged us down to the basement. It's changed completely a great deal under President Sweeney. This is a different international affairs operation. It's not a rubber stamp for the State Department. It's people that fight for real unions, independent unions. So big, big, big change.
Thanks for letting me have a follow-up, Jack.
Okay. Thanks for the call. We have a couple callers waiting, and we'll get on next to someone in Kingman, Indiana, on line number 4. Good morning.
Good morning. What an interesting program. I certainly hope you get a lot of airtime in the next 18 months. I believe that this problem cannot be solved by consumers, that this is a political problem, and as long as we keep putting into public office individuals who believe in not only big corporate business in America, but big global business, we're going to continue to have this problem. When we start putting people in office who can change the legislation that governs the underlying corporate policies, then we're going to see some changes. Yes, there's social pressure that needs to be brought to bear, but this is political. I mean, this is why the WTO in Cancun was shut down by the farmers revolting, by the developing countries revolting. There is groundswell around the world, but like you said earlier, education, 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 until enough people are aware of the situation and start speaking up, you're not going to have a lot of pressure brought to bear on the corporations that do this kind of stuff. I mean, this is really a political solution. I'm not sure that rolling back NAFTA is the answer either, because, you know, America is such a huge, large economy in relationship to so many other countries around the world. You got to kind of have things like NAFTA that do level the playing field a little bit and bring the lower countries a little bit up to our level. I'm not sure that NAFTA is a wonderful thing for Americans, but I'm not sure that it's a totally bad thing for the rest of the world either. And I'm just a person that really believes that we're all human beings on one planet, and the better we treat each other, the better we're going to be.
Well, I couldn't disagree with that. And exactly, it is a political issue. However, I think the point I'm trying to make is that unless we can take the issue of the global economy and put a human face on it and make it anecdotal and tell the story of this 16-year-old kid in Bangladesh, we're just not going to get the American people. Many of the American people do not know that there are rules governing global trade. They're surprised to hear it because it's done behind their backs. And so we need to find ways to bring more and more people into this work, and then hopefully, you know, they'll, of course, vote in the right direction for people who are going to defend worker rights. And as far as NAFTA goes, without core labor standards, the agreement is just completely tilted. So what's going on in Mexico right now, we were tracking Alcoa, which makes auto parts. The big aluminum company makes auto parts in Mexico, in Acuña and Piedra Negras. They had about 15,000 workers there. When we visited the workers in Acuña, they were living in cardboard huts put together with shipping crates, no running water, no heat, living in ways that are unimaginable. And in Piedra Negras, about 30% of the Alcoa workers were actually walking across the border in Texas to sell their blood to Baxter International, sell their plasma. They got $30 a week for two visits to the plasma center. They were living under those conditions. Well, you know what? Those jobs are too expensive now.
Yeah.
Because the base wage in Mexico is about $1.26. So those jobs are leaving. Alcoa, at this moment, is laying off 4,000 workers in Mexico. Those jobs are going to Nicaragua. Alcoa is about to set up a new plant in San Pedro Sula where they can pay their workers maybe 70 cents an hour. And there are auto parts plants being built at this minute in Nicaragua where they can pay the workers 43 cents to 50 cents. Or they can go to China and pay 27 cents an hour. So this race to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
If that's not controlled, these free trade agreements will only milk a country until the point that they can leave and go elsewhere. And so we have to have some basic standards below which we won't let the companies go.
You know, I love America. I think this is the greatest country on the face of the earth. But we have a responsibility to those countries and to those people and to those workers, because we do suck so many natural resources and human resources out of the rest of the world. People are talking right now, they're scratching their heads and they're wondering why Americans are so hated around the world. I can't help but think that this is one reason. Anyway, thank you very much. I'll hang up.
Thanks for the call. We have just about 10 minutes left with Charles Kernighan. He is Executive Director of the National Labor Committee, and our lines are basically full. I want to get on and include as many calls as we possibly can. We'll go next to a listener in Urbana on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, that Kathy Lee Gifford thing was the high point for me of the decade. I mean, that was wonderful. And you wonder, and people wonder why the World Trade Center was targeted. But I got two questions. One is, to what degree is the rest of the world allowing their wealthy classes to exploit poverty through sweatshops? Number one, and number two, what's it like trying to shame some of our biggest corporations through the mainstream media that depends on those corporations for their profits? So what's the rest of the world doing about letting people exploit people with sweatshops, and what's it like dealing with the mainstream media? And I'll hang up. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Well, the first question is basically, it's sad to say, but almost every country you visit, the worst factories in those countries will be Walmart. Walmart production will be in those factories. The workers call them the armpits of the country. So in many ways, it is the big, giant U.S. retailers which are dragging this whole thing down, cutting wages every year. Walmart, by the way, says to its contractors around the world, they're just going to lower their prices every single year, period. And, of course, inflation and other things, costs are going up in the developing world, so the squeeze is really on. And, of course, then the companies turn to the workers to squeeze them further because they're the weak link that they can take some money out of. So, but you do see European labels and Canadian labels made right next to U.S. labels. So basically, this is a free-for-all, a free-fall, and it's going to take some leveling of that playing field to block it. So, yes, you find Canadian labels like Gildan made right next to Nike and sweatshops in Honduras. You'll find products from France and Sweden made right next to Homedics products in China, you know, healthcare products. Workers working 16 hours a day, same thing, 7 days a week. So it's pretty much everyone, although they appear to have a little bit more influence over their companies in Europe than we have in the United States. As far as, like, shaming these companies through the mainstream media, frankly, we find out we work a lot with the media. We find out many times the media is a little bit lazy. So if you come to them with a complete story, with the documents, with the workers, with the clothing, with the other products, with film footage, with photographs, in some cases they can't ignore you. It's just that you have to work like mad to do all their work for them. And if you can go, sometimes you can break through. One of the ways we try to break through, like we're going to do in October, is make a tour of the country. We're going to make a tour across the United States with two young maquiladora workers from Honduras and Nicaragua and a union leader, woman union leader from Honduras. And as you go from town to town, city to city, university to university, you can draw some of the local media because it's becoming an issue. It's bouncing along. So it's very difficult, and you have to work very hard at it, but you cannot ignore the mainstream media because they determine so much in this country.
Okay. We have several callers waiting, and we'll get on next to a listener in Chicago on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. In a world that we have to have a law against murder, I mean, I agree with the one lady, this is predictable. We need laws against greed. And if we don't have regulation of how these jobs are being exported and put a stop to it, as you're saying, this downward spiral, we're leading the downward spiral because as our economy deteriorates, we have a large impact on the rest of the world. The only way we can turn it around where some small third world country's economy can turn around, we can't bring them up as we're going down the tubes. See what I'm saying? So somehow or another, the jobs have got to be brought back here. Regulation has to be stopped, that the exporting of jobs and what's gone has to be brought back. Then that can have a domino effect to bring these other companies back up, countries back into profit.
Yeah, unfortunately, I agree. Unfortunately, of course, it's going in the opposite direction. So, for example, the big three recently put the word out on the street that they wanted all of their auto part manufacturing plants to leave the country immediately. That was the word. There was no smoking gun. There was no letter, but they were told, get this work to China immediately. And so what we're seeing right now is this race to the bottom that it's going to accelerate like no one's ever seen before. As a matter of fact, last year, productivity in the United States was up 4.7%, the greatest rise in 50 years in worker productivity. Labor costs to the U.S. companies went down 1.7%, the greatest decline on record to the U.S. companies in terms of labor costs. We still lost these 2.78 million jobs. And at the time that under the Bush administration, we lost 2.78 million jobs, China gained 45 million jobs because those auto parts can be made in China on wages of 27 cents an hour. I toured factories making Alpine Costeras, $1,300 a piece made in China. The workers were getting 27 cents an hour to make them. So the race to the bottom now is going to go, it's going to accelerate like no one has ever seen before. And if we don't get those laws against greed or those fundamental laws beneath which the companies can't go, there's nothing's going to stop this.
Apologies to the last caller, but our lines are full and we have about 4 minutes left. I'll go next to a listener on a cell phone on line number two. Good morning.
Hi.
Yes.
I just wanted to make two very brief comments, one of which I think goes to the host. and that is, could we not have a mention of how much a person makes per hour? Because that's really not a relevant issue. The question is, what is the purchasing power that a person has? And how is this standing relative to the community in which he lives? The absolute dollar amount, or in many cases in third world penny amount, really is not a fair statement of how bad the people are.
Okay, and, well, that's a fair point.
The second comment is simply this. My grandfather came from a ghetto in the Ukraine, and he worked in the garment district in New York City, where he worked in a sweatshop. And I'm not sure that sweatshops should always be considered to be bad if they're a step towards going to a better society. His sons both became professors. I know this doesn't happen in the third world countries, but the idea that a sweatshop per se is bad isn't really necessarily true. And I think that needs to be, you know, qualified in terms of, are other generations going to do better because of the way their parents are working?
Okay.
Thank you. That's all I wanted to say.
Thanks for your points. We have just about 2 minutes left. Mr. Kernighan, if someone is making, you know, what seems to us like a very little amount, should we take that as an indication that they're in abject poverty, or is the standard of living different, or what would you say?
Well, it's a good question, but I mean, basically, if you look at the videos we've made and the pictures that we've taken, and if you speak to the workers we've brought on tour, you'll know they are living in abject misery. And their goal is to climb out of misery and into poverty. They're not asking to live like we live in the United States. They're asking to be able to feed their families two or three meals a week. If you visited the homes, if the American people could see how these garment workers in Bangladesh are living, I can guarantee you a good number of people break down in tears, living in tiny hovels with sewage right beneath their beds because of the floods. Workers can't sleep at night because these huts leak, so you work 16 hours a day, but then when you go home and it rains, you can't sleep. In other words, no one's talking about living conditions that are acceptable. We would not even put our lawn furniture in the houses that these workers live in around the world, whether it's the maquiladora along Mexico's border, or whether it's the dorm rooms in China where 16 people share a room, or whether it's these broken-down hovels, makeshift hovels in Bangladesh. So basically, those are the kinds of conditions we're talking about. Why we make a point of the dollar salary is you have workers in Bangladesh, for example, making caps for the universities in the United States, and they're being paid about 3 cents for every cap they make, meaning their wages come to about 0.1% of the retail price. In other words, it would be very, very possible to double the workers' wages. So in their own words, they could climb out of misery and into poverty. And as far as sweatshops being, you know, perhaps a good thing, maybe when there are unions, maybe when you have some rights, maybe when you can pass legislation like happened in the United States under the New Deal, yes, sweatshops were wiped out in the United States by 1938. Well, of course, they're back now with a vengeance because of the global economy. And if you try to organize in China, you're going to prison. You may be given electric shock treatment. In other words, and in Bangladesh, there's not one single union in any of those 3,600 factories. You're crushed immediately. So your ability to fight back has been taken away. And if that had happened in the United States, it would be a very different story. And perhaps the gentleman would be in a sweatshop rather than in a university.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, and there's several calls that we won't be able to take since we're out of time, but I promise we'll come back to this topic. Our guest has been Charles Kernighan. He's Executive Director of the National Labor Committee, and the website for the National Labor Committee, again, www.nlcnet.org. And to you, Mr. Kernighan, thanks so much for giving us your time again.
Hey, thank you.
All right.